city-state and island country of Singapore, where history has now been made. The heads of state of two nations, still at war since 1953, met face-to-face for the first time. United States President Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. We spoke to President Trump shortly after this historic meeting, and this is what he said. What surprised you today about Kim Jong-un?
Really, he's got a great personality. He's a, you know, funny guy. He's a very smart guy. He's a great negotiator. He loves his people. Not that I'm surprised by that, but he loves his people. And I think that we have a, you know, the start of an amazing deal. We're going to denuke North Korea. It's going to start immediately. And a lot of other things are happening, including getting the remains back. You know, it's been, I know you've been so involved in so many ways in North Korea, but getting the remains back, Greta, is so important to so many people. They've called me. They've written me letters. Please, can you do it? And he's agreed to do that. Thousands of people. So, you know, who died in the war. So that's a big deal.
So you put the human rights issue on the table today, and he reacted how?
Very well. I mean, we obviously were talking about the denuclearization 90% of the time, but we put a lot of other things, including human rights were mentioned. Getting the remains back were a big factor. In fact, we put it in the document. We're able to get that in the document. We got a lot of good things in that document. That was far beyond what anyone thought was going to happen.
Give me some sort of behind the scenes. Did you issue an ultimatum to him? Did he issue an ultimatum to you?
No,
what was the reaction in the back and forth?
Not an ultimatum. We, you know, we've been dealing for 3 months, really, and we've been dealing through our various representatives, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who's done a really fantastic job. So we've been dealing for a pretty good period of time. And when we met today, we got along right from the beginning. You know, for me, it's this is hour number 25. I haven't been sleeping for 25 hours. It's been a big, long negotiation, and I'm very proud of it. It starts a process, you know, that could have ended up in a war, that could have ended up with many millions of people. You know North Korea very well. Seoul has 28 million people. That could have ended up with millions of people dead, and we're going to end up with a deal.
All right. What about our troops? Are they staying in South Korea?
Yeah, they're going to stay. We didn't even discuss that. That wasn't discussed. We are going to get out of the war games that cost so much money. You know, where we, because I think, number one, it's very provocative, and I want to do it, and I think they're very happy about it because it is so provocative. But it costs a fortune to do it, and we won't do that as long as we're negotiating in good faith.
What brought him to the table this time? Because, you know, there's been a lot of saber rattling back and forth over decades with DPRK in the U.S.
Well, actually, I don't think there's been too much saber rattling prior to me. I don't think they basically had a silencio attitude, silence. They didn't want to talk about it, and you can't do that. And I think the initial rhetoric was very important, frankly, as much as I hated to do it and as much as some people thought I was doing the wrong thing. I think without that, we wouldn't be here. I also think that he really wants to make a deal. He wants to do something. Because he knows that we mean business. I don't think he felt that in the past. I think in the past it was, look, it was different people. It didn't work out. But he knows that we want to do business. We have to do business. And we will do business. And now we do have, it's been, you know, not a long time, but although you could say that from day one we've been talking about North Korea and in a very tough manner. But I think we signed a document today which was far, far greater and more comprehensive than people thought. Nobody thought this was possible.
What do you think he thought of you after he left?
I think he liked me, and I like him, and I understand the past. And, you know, nobody has to tell me he's a rough guy. He has to be a rough guy, or he has been a rough person. But we got along very well. He's smart, loves his people. He loves his country. He wants a lot of good things, and that's why he's doing this.
But he's starved them. He's been brutal to them. He still loves his people?
Look, he's doing what he's seen done. I mean, you know, if you look at it, but I really have to go by today and by yesterday and by a couple of weeks ago, because that's really when this whole thing started. Again, without the rhetoric and without the sanctions were very important. The sanctions are going to remain on until such time as we see, you know, this is going to happen. And we pretty much see that now, but the sanctions will remain on until we really start dismantling or dismantle the nuclear weapons.
Because this is Voice America, it will be heard in North Korea by the citizens of DPRK of North Korea. What do you want to say directly to the citizens of North Korea?
Well, I think you have somebody that has a great feeling for them. He wants to do right by them. And We got along really well. We had a great chemistry. You understand how I feel about chemistry. It's very important. I mean, I know people where there is no chemistry. No matter what you do, it just don't have it. We had it right from the beginning. I talked about that. And I think great things are going to happen for North Korea.
Mr. President, nice to see you all the way from Washington.
That's true. It's been a long time. At some point, I'll be able to go to sleep, I think, you know, get a little rest.
Indeed. Have a safe trip
back,
sir.
Thank you, Greg. It's a great honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Wen Jing-hui is an assistant professor at Nanyang Technological University here in Singapore. He reminded us of the very tortured history on the Korean Peninsula.
Normally, people start the story from 1945 after World War II ends, but I think we need to see the story in a much bigger, like a longer time frame. And you'd probably want to start with Japan annexing Korea in 1910. And from 1932 onwards, the people who would form the core of the North Korean regime started off as a resistance movement, and they were allied with the communists, and they continued to fight against the Japanese all the way till World War II ended. So these guys would form the core of the North Korean regime. And when the United States saw that the Pacific War was coming to an end in 1945, they were very worried that when the Soviets were entering the North, they would bring with them a lot of North Koreans who were part of the guerrilla movement against the Japanese. And so they moved towards a military occupation of the South in 1945, about 3 weeks after the bombing of Nagasaki. And the War Department and the State Department officials decided that 38th parallel would be the place to draw the line in order to contain what would eventually become the Cold War conflict against the Soviet Union. So, yeah, that division happens around 1945. Yeah.
Well, it's been at quite a cost to the people who actually occupy the Korean Peninsula, because at one time they were one, and then you have these other nations that divide it into two.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think part of the problem of that transition is that when the United States looked for people to govern their South Korean ally, they tended to actually re-employ a lot of Koreans who had served in the Japanese military government during that Japanese occupation period. So a lot of these guys wanting to control the state tended to put down a lot of like dissidents in a very violent way. So, you know, some scholars estimate between 100 to 200,000 South Koreans suffered under the Southern regime, while the North regime went into its own sort of repressive habits because they were afraid of what would happen if the South started to get aggressive as well.
Well, we saw Kim Jong-un travel to China. He's been there twice. Yep. And also he was brought here to Singapore on a Chinese aircraft. So China, it appears, has sort of really stepped up as a player in the summit.
Yes, yes, definitely. And I think China was always part of the story from like the very beginning. The Korean guerrillas who were fighting against the Japanese were often under the command of Chinese communist officers. And Kim Il-sung, grandfather of Jong-un, was actually a member of the Chinese Communist Party way back 20s and 1930s. So he took a lot of that experience into his regime when it was established in the 1940s.
And of course, Japan is also plays into this whole story. And Japan, of course, still is disturbed about some kidnappings by North Korea.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that scholars and observers tend to say about Korea is that the shape of Korea geographically is a dagger pointed into the heart of the Japan. And I think when the Americans were interested in turning Japan into a friendly capitalist ally after World War II, they were most worried about the possibility of all of Korea turning communist and becoming a strategic threat directly to a Japanese recovery and reconstruction. So Japan definitely is worried about not only what North Korea could do, but also its own stability in the region, because Korea geographically has always looked like that dagger pointed at Japan.
President Moon of South Korea, is he different from past presidents in terms of his approach to North Korea?
Well, I can't say how far different it would be. I think that there have been many overtures from the South towards the North, you know, in the 1990s on the Sunshine Policy. But it does look like current President Moon is very assertive. He is proactive about cultivating relations with the North as well as the United States. So I think he sees an opportunity. I can't speak to how different it'll be, because I guess it depends on how the summit goes and whether or not we can see the impact of the way that he's tried to liaise between the U.S. and North Korea.
You know, for most part of the world, most people, The United States is still at war with North Korea. Mm-hmm. There's never been a peace agreement signed. Since 1953, there's been no peace agreement. Everybody sort of walked away. Right. I mean, this is a historic moment, isn't it? The two presidents, no matter what happens.
Yes, no matter what happens. And this is the first time the sitting president is actually meeting in this type of fashion. I think previously, when the North Korean leaders were meeting with an American delegate, it was a past president, like Jimmy Carter and, like, you know, Bill Clinton and everything. So I think this is a historic summit. Can't really be sure what will come of it, but I think a better sense of what North Korea's historical impressions are of American power and Japanese power prior to that will give us a better idea of how to maybe meet them halfway and encourage them to meet us halfway as well.
What do you make of the fact that Kim Jong-un released some Americans who were in custody? Mm-hmm. He's traveled, of course, to China twice. He's been to South Korea. He's also, there's been a destruction of at least of one nuclear testing site. There's some question the extent of how much the destruction is. But has he changed, or is this an olive leaf, or is this what's your impression of this, or is this a trick?
Is it a trick?
How do you describe this?
Well, I would see all the members of the Kim family since Kim Il-sung is very savvy players. I think they understand what a lot of like international politics are like, and that big gestures, grand gestures, are important for the international press to gain sympathy. And so, I mean, these are things that his grandfather and his father have done in different measure. I think Kim Jong-un's actions appear to be much larger. Maybe, you know, they have a greater range. So it's not, I think, clear to me how different it is from the past. But perhaps you might say that there's a difference in terms of degree.
But there's been such a standoff between the two nations. And while Kim Jong-un was releasing the Americans and making those gestures, the United States in many ways still had tough talk for North Korea.
Yeah.
It wasn't as though the United States was saying anything more except get rid of your nuclear weapons and we'll welcome you into the world economy.
Right. And I think that the bigger the gestures are from North Korea, the more I think that international opinion could tilt in that direction, that this guy does seem to be different from the North Korea of the past, that is only inward-looking, or is a garrison state, or something like that. So I think it's a very savvy and very smart play. Whether or not it turns out to be a trick or whatever, it's not really clear at this time.
But while he's making those gestures, he's also has a history of executing his uncle, mm-hmm. his half-brother.
Yep.
You hear about these terrible camps.
Yep.
I've been to North Korea three times and seen the people don't seem to be eating particularly well. They're smaller people because of the because there isn't food is not readily available to everybody.
Right.
So there's that side of him as well.
Yes, and I think it's a battle for what is the current memory of all those types of like exploitative and repressive measures that clearly the Kim regime over time has been practicing. So they're battling over the memory of that, maybe trying to seize this particular moment to foreground a different type of regime's behavior. Whether or not that works, I think not all of us have a short memory, as you just said, and I think that helps us to balance out however clever or however smart this move is that he's making.
What does it mean to Singapore to hold this summit?
Well, I think most of my Singaporean friends are very pleased. I think that Singapore is getting the opportunity to be part of this. I understand from the watching the foreign minister that Singapore didn't volunteer for this, but both sides asked, both North Korea as well as the United States asked. And so I think it was a fantastic opportunity to be a part of it as a neutral party to host this. I think that some Singaporeans are thinking about how inconvenient it is to actually go to where they want to go because of all the barricades and the traffic stops and stuff like that. But I think It's an opportunity, and it's a great moment that two sides can actually get together and speak here.
Well, you've been very gracious hosts. Singapore has been very gracious to all of us in the foreign media.
Yes.
And so we appreciate it. And thank you very much for doing the interview, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I also spoke with Tai-Wei Lim, who is a senior lecturer at SIM University and a research fellow at the National University of Singapore East Asian Institute. He told me about Japan and China's role in this historic event. Sir.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
So tell me, is China more involved in this in the summit than originally been involved in trying to get North Korea to denuclearize?
I think we can see that China is intensely involved before the summit because Mr. Kim has made two trips to China, once by train to Beijing and the other time by plane to Dalian, where he was seen strolling along the beach with President Xi Jinping. And I think yesterday when Mr. Kim arrived, he actually arrived in an Air China Boeing jet provided by the national carrier of Beijing. So in that sense, China is very much involved in the summit or the preparations towards the summit.
Well, what took so long in the sense that why wasn't China a year ago or 2 years ago seemingly more aggressive in trying to facilitate some denuclearization? Or were they behind the scenes?
I think what has changed is probably not China itself, but the willingness of Mr. Kim and also President Trump of the U.S. to talk to each other. And I think we could see the start of a sort of a makings of a rapprochement beginning from the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, when Mr. Kim sent his sister, Ms. Kim Yo-jong, to South Korea, Seoul, to Pyeongchang. And she managed to talk to President Moon Jae-in of South Korea. And President Moon passed on messages from Ms. Kim to Washington, D.C., as well as to Tokyo.
Does China have an interest in making sure that Kim Jong-un remains in power, or does it fear that if Kim Jong-un collapses, for instance, or steps down or is no longer the leader, that there will be refugees from North Korea into the border, into China?
I think the nearest hint of China's thinking is during the trilateral summit in Tokyo, when Premier Li Keqiang attended the trilateral summit between China, Japan and South Korea. In it, they say that they support peace on the Korean Peninsula. What they really want to see is, of course, a stable Korean Peninsula. And also, in the past, they have mentioned de-escalation of U.S. South Korea annual exercises. So those are things that they've mentioned in the past, but it appears this time round that they are supportive of the peace process.
Does China want a unified Korean Peninsula?
China has not managed to say that very clearly and unambiguously. They have talked more in terms of peace, and they don't seem to mention anything about regime change in the Korean Peninsula.
What if there is no agreement to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula? What does China think or do or say at that point? All right, the goal of President Trump in the United States is denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Does China think that's ever a possibility?
So far, we have heard three models of denuclearization. The Libyan model, which has been rejected by Pyongyang in the strongest term. We have also the Trump model, which comes with CVID, complete verifiable irreversible denuclearization in exchange for economic incentives from the US. And the third model is proposed by Pyongyang, which is called the synchronous and phased withdrawal model. The phased withdrawal model simply means that at every step that Pyongyang denuclearizes, they want to have something in exchange constantly and consistently. In this summit, if the talks turn out to be successful, we are quite likely to see a compromise and perhaps a hybrid model coming up with some new features so that the common position of both countries can be preserved as far as possible.
When you talk about the phased way that the North Koreans are suggesting what they see, how different is that from the agreed framework that President Clinton entered into with North Korea? That was also on a phased aspect too, but the North Korea cheated.
It appears that this round, Pyongyang is suggesting something even more drawn out and something much more clearly visible for every step that it denuclearizes. And it appears that they're willing to open up the facilities for verification. However, it still remains unclear the details of this phased withdrawal model. They've only outlined the broad features. We need to look at the details after the summit when common statements have been issued.
Why did Kim Jong-un agree to go to the summit? What's in it for him?
Kim Jong-un is a young leader. He has just consolidated his power. He's removed many of his father's old trusted lieutenants in the leadership change. Right, and he has, at this moment, fully consolidated his power, at least domestically. What he wants is an avoidance of regime change, that is a survival for his dynasty and his regime in his own country. And he sees denuclearization as a possibility for regime preservation.
But all along they've been saying the reason that they have nuclear weapons, what they're telling all their people is essentially that the Americans are going to nuke them if they don't have these weapons. And so how does Kim Jong-un give up these weapons if they've been telling the people all along that they need them to protect themselves against the United States?
At this very current preliminary stage, what Mr. Kim has done is to tell his people that North Korea already has the weapon. Therefore, there's no need for further testing. However, he's likely to seek more security guarantees from Beijing and Moscow in exchange for any opening up of his country for economic development, especially from the West, from Japan and South Korea.
You mean that he would go to Russia and to China and say that in the event the United States violates the agreement and attacks us, that they will protect him, protect his regime?
He probably, and we don't know at this moment, probably sought that when he went to Beijing the first time round before he met any foreign leaders for this upcoming summit. He's been there twice, once through the train, through the plane, and he's also mentioned publicly that after the summit, he will go to Beijing again. So we can see a lot of coordination and communication between the two capital cities.
All right, there have been a series of sanctions that have been imposed on North Korea. Have those sanctions hurt North Korea? Is that one of the reasons why he has come to the table?
That's definitely one of the reasons. North Korea is feeling the effects of and the pressure of the sanctions. And the U.S. has been very strong in imposing the sanction with all of the international community's support, including China's support. So the U.S. in this sense has achieved some success in pressuring North Korea. And this kind of also affects North Korea's own domestic agenda, which is for economic development in their own country. So one of Mr. Kim's motivation and incentive for coming to the summit is that he's able to develop his own country economically without the sanction. That's one of the things that he hopes to achieve.
What do you expect humanitarian issues to be on the table? We've got the situation where they kidnapped the Japanese, and Japan, of course, wants an accountability or these kidnapped victims returned. You've got the situation where he murdered his half-brother, or at least North Korea murdered his half-brother in a Malaysian airport. You've got that his uncle was executed, and you've got all these camps. So there's this humanitarian issue that's sitting out there. Do you expect that to be part of the discussions at all, or is it only nuclear weapons? So the United States for 73 years plus has been at war with North Korea. There's been no peace agreement signed. Meanwhile, people in South Korea have grown up. There have been a couple generations. Are the younger generation, those under the age of 20, are they living in fear of nuclear weapons or not? Are they just going about their day? Because the rest of the world is talking about nuclear weapons, but they're so very close to North Korea.
Not just the South Koreans living in fear of nuclear weapons. The Japanese are also living in fear of nuclear weapons. But realistically, for both South Korea and Japanese, even more worrying is, especially for the Japanese, is the stockpile of chemical weapons that Mr. Kim's regime have. And they are missile capable. They are capable of reportedly being fired using Soviet-era Scud missiles. So besides nuclear weapons as weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons are also another lethal weapons of mass destruction that's a cause for worry. Further away in Beijing and Moscow, both capital cities are worried about further nuclear testing because of nuclear pollution coming from North Korea. So all of them have huge stakes to ensure that there's peace on Korean Peninsula.
What do you think is going to happen? How is Kim Jong-un different from or like his father Kim Jong-il or his grandfather Kim Il-sung?
He does not have a fear of flying. The fact that he's here in an airplane makes him different. He's also educated in the West, in Switzerland. And so that makes him different from his father and his grandfather. And he's not kind of constrained by a Cold War Soviet era system or ways of thinking. He has much more freedom to do what he wants by consolidating his power, by removing potential rival, including executing his own uncle. He has a sort of support of the machinery of the Workers' Party and the military. So that makes him a person that can make decisions on behalf of the regime and on behalf of his dynasty.
Think he could ever trust the United States?
If economic sanctions are lifted because of success of denuclearization and if investments from the U.S. goes into North Korea, then we may have a chance to see yet another socialist country that will sort of convert to a market economy. If that happens, I think the people of North Korea will appreciate economic development as an incentive for peace and also outreach to all other countries, including the United States.
Well, this really is a historic time, isn't it?
This is definitely a historic time because the North Korean leader has never been out of his country as a leader, besides Dalian that has taken place and also his train trips to Beijing. So he's a person that we know very little about, and this is an opportunity for him and his regime to reach out to the world and to integrate with the international community.
And before we leave, we at Voice of America want to give a shout-out and a big thanks to the people of Singapore. They were incredibly gracious hosts to all of us in the media who descended upon their city-state for this historic summit. And I leave you with some of the beautiful sights of Singapore.